These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled The Story of Human Language, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor John McWhorter. Professor McWhorter is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He earned his BA from Rutgers University, his MA from New York University, and his PhD in linguistics from Stanford University. Prior to taking his position at Manhattan, he held teaching positions at Cornell University and the University of California at Berkeley. Professor McWhorter specializes in language change and language contact. He is the author of The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. He has also written a book on dialects and Black English, The Word on the Street. His articles have been published in The New Republic, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The Chronicle of Higher Education, and The New York Times. Frequently sought after by the media, Dr. McWhorter has appeared on Dateline, NBC, Politically Incorrect, Talk of the Nation, Today, Good Morning America, The Jim Lehrer News Hour, and Fresh Air, and does regular commentaries for All Things Considered. His latest book is Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music in America and Why We Should, Like, Care. Professor McWhorter prepared the course guide that comes with these lectures. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a timeline, maps, glossary, and bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. What is language?
To lay the groundwork for this series, what we want to establish before we look at the natural history of language is exactly what we mean by language, and this is how linguists study language in particular. And it's important to realize that as easy as it is to think that a language is just a collection of words, a language is a lot more than that. It's not only the words, but it's the grammar that we use to put the words together in order to convey an utterance, and even in order to affect the world by the utterances that we produce. So, for example, you could know 5,000 words in a foreign language. You could cram them all into your head with flashcards. And still, you wouldn't be able to say things like, she might as well finish it, getting in that nuance of might as well and what that means. Or you probably wouldn't know how to say, it happened to be on a Tuesday. In many other languages, you wouldn't use the word for happen. That's just one way happen happens to be used. But it's things like that that are language. It's something very unique that we can do. It's easy to look at animals and the way they communicate and to think, well, they can talk too. And there's even kind of a strain among some people to resist the notion that there's something unique that human beings do when it comes to language. And in this first lecture, I want to get across what I'm always going to mean by this wonderful thing called language with some examples from the animal kingdom and why they're not quite getting to where we are. Then we're going to look at the very beginnings of language among humans as far as we know at this point. But in general, we can start with the fact that animals, even though they communicate, are not exactly using language. And so, for example, I love dogs and cats as much as anybody. You can kind of communicate with them. But Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, once said, a dog cannot relate his autobiography. However eloquently he may bark, he can't tell you that his parents were honest, though poor. And that's true. There's an awful lot that a dog simply could not say. Bees are an example of how animals can communicate to an extent. And so it's been found that in their hive, a bee can tell the other bees where honey is based on this kind of dance. It goes in the direction where the honey is, and then it waggles its posterior with a certain frequency that corresponds with how far away the honey is, and it vibrates kind of frenetically while doing this waggling to indicate how rich the source is. That's pretty neat. And so bees can actually tell each other which way to swarm. That's absolutely fabulous, and that's all they can do. They can't talk about anything. They can't talk about where anything else is. They can't convey concepts. There's just this one thing, absolutely miraculous, that allows them to communicate in that one way about that one thing. So that is communication, but bees cannot chew the fat. They only do that one thing. So that's one level of communication, but it's not exactly language. Now, apes are better than bees at this kind of thing. And there have been all sorts of attempts to get some sort of speech out of apes. I recently had occasion to deal with a chimpanzee, and they do seem to look at you with almost human eyes. At one point, the chimpanzee reached up with its finger and went like this and took it down with the same poise that we use in scratching our nose. They're little human beings. So you would think, well, can't you talk? And the fact is that they can just approximate what we're doing, but never get terribly impressively far. It goes way back to hope that you could make these queer little semi-people talk. Samuel Pepys, who was a man of affairs in Restoration England, encountered a baboon, and he writes about it in his diary, which is very quotidian and colloquial. And at one point, he said, "It's a great baboon, but so like a man in most things that yet I can't believe but that it is a monster got of a man and a she baboon. I do believe it already understands much English, and I am of the mind it might be taught to speak or make signs." So, people have tried to teach apes how to talk, and it doesn't really get too far. In 1909, there was a little chimpanzee, and it learned to say mama, and that was it. Then in 1916, there was an orangutan, and it learned how to say papa and cup, and that was as far as he got. Then in the 1940s, there was a chimpanzee that could say papa, mama, cup, and up. Up referring to it wanting to be picked up. But it never got any more words than that. That's not language. That's communication. So parental units, cup probably with something good in it, and being picked up. But that was it. That's different from talking about how you saw a strange-looking piece of fish and ate it and it made you sick or something like that. So they only went so far. Now, there have been times when things went a little further, and there's a large literature about this. Washo, the chimpanzee, 1966. Washo was taken when she was about a year old, and after about 3 months, she started being able to sign. And Washo was in the company of people who really wanted to see how far we could take in teaching these creatures to sign, because one suspects that there's something about their vocal apparatus that keeps them from being able to do this, but maybe they could do it with their hands, because humans, of course, have sign languages, which are very much full, nuanced languages. So by the time Washo was 4, she had 132 signs, and that's pretty darn good. And she was taught open by opening a door, and then she could mentally extend that to, say, taking a lid off of something or taking a lid off of a pot, which is a kind of an advanced cognition to think of both of those things as opening. At one point, the big dramatic moment with Washo was there was a pond somewhere in New York City, and a swan went by, and Washo pointed at it and with her hands said, "Water bird." Now, that's pretty darn good. She knew water, and she knew bird, and then she called this thing something. Now, even if maybe she was saying that that bird is in the water, that's pretty good for something that's not supposed to be able to talk. And also that Washo pointed this out on her own, and so nobody said, "There's this thing, what is it?" It's just that all of a sudden she pointed and said it. So Washo was pretty interesting. And there have been other cases of apes that learned something kind of like language. But there are limits. For example, They are inconsistent. It's one thing to talk about Waterbird or things like me, you, out, which Washoe would say to indicate let's go out. The thing is that actually, generally, if there are two or more words at a time, then apes will understand most of the time, but not all. They misunderstand a lot more than even a small child would. So it seems that it can only penetrate so far for them. Then there's the issue of, are they understanding grammar or are they going from context? So for example, you can say, put the sour cream in the cooler. Now there, it's clear that put is the action, the sour cream is the object, and the cooler is what we might call a prepositional object as linguists, but suffice it to say that that's where the sour cream should go. So those are those three big elements. Now, as it happens, you can also sign cooler, sour cream, put, and an ape might then go put the sour cream in the cooler. Some people have said, well, that means that they understand grammar. They understand that one of these things is the action, one of these things is the object, and you can scramble it around and they can still tell. But really, there's a lot of context, too, because you couldn't put the cooler in the sour cream. If you put the cooler on top of the sour cream, then as an ape, you couldn't get to it and you wouldn't want that. Obviously, if there's pudding and sour cream and cooler, then you are going to put the cream into the cooler. That's not necessarily understanding grammar. That's just being a relatively sentient being in the world. So one wonders. Then there's the imitation issue, which is easy to lose in the literature sometimes, which is that 40% of the time, one of the apes that got the best at this would imitate a human while being signed to. So the human starts and then the ape starts doing it with them. Now that's cute in a way, but it's also different from the way we use language. Children apparently do this at the rate of about 5% of the time. This would often be at the ends of sentences. But imagine telling a child, go upstairs and get your toy, and you say, go up, and by the time you get to stairs, the child is looking up and saying, stairs and get your toy. That would be a very peculiar and probably slightly deficient child. There's something wrong with that kid. That is about as good as apes can do. Part of it is imitative, and that's different from actually communicating. And so it seems that between the imitation and the fact that they have a way of misinterpreting and the fact that there's little evidence that they're actually seeing the grammar, there's clearly something different. And Charles Hockett was one of the most prominent linguists in America. And a while ago, he listed 13 features that distinguish human language from, for example, what bees can do and what apes had been shown to be able to do when Hockett wrote. And among them, one of them was what's called displacement. And that is that one thing that we can do with language, although we often don't have to think about this consciously, is we can talk about something that isn't there. It's in the past, it might be in the future, it might be hypothetical. And so we can say, there are giant squid 50 feet long, and once I was walking along the beach and I found one of the carcasses washed up. You can talk about that having happened 10 years ago. That could happen to some ape that happens to live near the shore. But the ape couldn't communicate that to any other ape. No animal could communicate that to another animal. Something completely displaced. The other day I saw some queer colored berries on a bush. And I ate them and you know they weren't really as bad as you might think. No matter how expressive and communicative an orangutan is, that's just not going to come out. He can only talk about bananas, get out of my way, things that are right there. So that's kind of different. Then there's what's called productivity, which means that you can take the elements of language and combine them in infinite combinations. So it's not just eat a banana, wanting a banana, or where's the banana. It's all sorts of things about the banana. The banana tastes good. The banana is broken. I'm going to break this banana so that I can fit it into the cooler, etc. This sort of what's called productivity is a hallmark of what we're doing. And this is not something that animals are so good at. Also, even the really hot-shotted chimpanzees rarely initiate conversation. If you're using language, you have a thought, and you say something. You might be the kind of ape that happens to keep things to itself, but there would presumably be some of them that were just running their mouths all the time, as they do within their limits, all of that chattering that, you know, apes and chimpanzees tend to do. But it's very rare for one of these quote-unquote talking chimpanzees to look up and say, you know, You know, even something like, maybe there'd be, I'd like a banana, but that's rare. You have to start it out with banana, you know, Washoe, and then she'll tell you, or would tell you if she were here. But in general, there's nothing along the lines of it's a nice day. There's all evidence to suggest that the higher primates do know that it's a nice day. Bonobos will sit down and put their arms around each other and look at the sunset. That's how close they are to us. But never has any ape said, you know, it's nice out, or something like that. You have to start it with them. So basically, it's a game to them. The bit about the swan was marvelous because really it was a one-off surprise. So there is that difference. There are eerie experiments with parrots where you see some of the same combinations of marvel and limitation. So, for example, Irene Pepperberg is a professor of psychology at Brandeis, and she has an African gray parrot named Alex. And since the late 70s, she's been training Alex to talk. Parrots are pretty remarkable. You can get that sense of human soul in them, too. They don't have the opposable thumb, but they definitely seem to have some sort of higher consciousness in the impressionistic sense. I spent a weekend with one of those birds once, and it's odd. They have a gamut of emotions. They prefer one person to another for no good reason. They're just like us. And they also talk in their way. And so Irene Pepperberg has gotten amazing results out of little Alex. You can ask him, what object is green and three-cornered? And there happens to be one in his play box. And he will tell you whatever Irene Pepperberg happens to have named that object. Alex can count to six, and there are indications that he kind of knows what that means. He can ask for food, saying things like, "Want a nut?" And he actually wants a nut, and he gets it. And he actually can spell a bit, because Irene Pepperberg has taught him how to break things down into sounds. And he gets impatient. And so at one point, she was showing him to researchers and she was asking him questions about naming sounds, but he wanted a nut. And so finally, apparently, he slit his eyes and said, "Want a nut? N-E-T." He knew. That's pretty good. You know, that's really a talking bird. But the fact is, Alex is not like the talking parrot in the Flintstones that I'm imitating right now. There are limits. It's clear that really he thinks that language is a game. So sometimes you will say something like, "What color is this, Alex?" And the marvel is that he can do this. But a lot of the time he'll just start rattling off the colors because he doesn't really feel like it. It seems that he's only vaguely aware that there's some sort of correspondence between naming things like this and the world that we live in and doing something with it. The brain kind of stops there. And also, as far as answering questions, yes, he can answer them, but only 4 out of 5 times right. What about the other 5? Now, if that were a human being, we would assume there was something seriously wrong. And he's a very well-behaved bird, too. It's just that it seems that what we've taught Alex to do is kind of a party trick. It's a game. It's not a mode of expression. So Irene Pepperberg has done wonderful work with Alex, but it's very hard to say that Alex is really holding conversations, that Alex is experiencing language like us. And what it really all comes down to is that there are no apes that sign in the wild in any way. Presumably they wouldn't use our signs, but they don't have any of their own. If this was something that was natural, then presumably they'd do it. Parrots are not running around talking to each other in the wild. They don't communicate with each other on any level higher than any other bird, screaming and yelling and beaking and all the things that they do. So we can get them to do this, but clearly we're kind of pushing their limits, and really, a lot of them clearly would rather not. That's not their nature. And it clearly is ours. So there's something very different. And to pull the camera back, thinking about what the bees do, thinking about if we can get beyond the understandable sentiment, what our dogs and cats cannot do, what even these almost human beings with, in some cases, DNA 98.5% of ours cannot do, what Alex the parrot cannot do. And we see that what we're doing is light years beyond what even the best of them can do. That is what we mean by language, and that's what every human being, for the most part, does, and does very well, despite the fact that language is very complicated. So it's often been wondered, when did human language arise of this kind. There's grunting, and then there's, many people would say there was a kind of half language, but when did this thing that I'm doing now start? And it's often been thought that Homo sapiens is defined partly by this ability to use complex language, that this is actually more central to what being human is than we might think. It's been thought that probably Cro-Magnon men spoke, and many would say that Neanderthals could just grunt. And for a while, there was an interesting theory that got a certain amount of attention, and justifiably, by Philip Lieberman, who is in the Cognitive and Linguistic Science Department at Brown. And Lieberman had the idea that human larynxes sit lower in our throat than in animals, and that this allows our oral cavity, like from the side, to be longer, and that that's what allows us to speak in a sophisticated way in terms of sound production and making a wide range of vowels and consonants. And what made him say that was because apes have higher larynxes, just like dogs do, just like tiny children do, and they can't talk yet, and Neanderthal larynxes can be shown to have been higher. And so it seems that the larynx came down and allowed us to be able to make this kind of sophisticated sound, and even at the expense of danger. If you think about it, if you have a dog, never does a dog start choking on its food. You know, and dogs are messy, impulsive little creatures knocking vases over and stuff. But one thing they don't do, no matter how happy they are, is they wolf that food up. There's no such thing as having to bang your dog on the back and give it the Heimlich maneuver. They don't do that because the larynx is up, so the food slides past the larynx. With us, the reason that's a danger is because our larynx is lower. We swallow the food, it might go down the right pipe, wrong pipe, and we could die. And apparently, it could be said that the reason that happened was because it allows us to speak, which would assist us in thriving as a species. The fact is that the Lieberman hypothesis, it's one of those things that's so pleasant, you want that to be true. I'm not sure it is based on evidence that has come up since. And one of the most difficult things is that the larynx only lowers starting in puberty. And no, infants can't talk, but certainly 8-year-old boys can. And so that suggests that the larynx couldn't be the whole story. And then there's some other things. It's not absolutely sure that the Neanderthals' larynxes were that low. That's the kind of thing that you really only get certain suggestions of in a skeleton as opposed to a corpse. And there are other things that suggest that maybe that idea might not be as promising as was once thought. But you find it often in the literature, and it is interesting. But nowadays, there are other ideas as to when language might have started. And where a lot of it begins is with the fact that it's pretty generally agreed now that Homo sapiens probably began about 150,000 years ago, which is not that long, if you think about it, not millions, just 150,000. And many have said that there's a kind of a big bang just 50,000 years ago. If you follow up on this subject, you'll find this again and again. That 50,000 years ago, suddenly there is the kind of art that suggests some sort of conceptual sophistication and all sorts of developments that you find that suggest that there was some sort of leap from, quote-unquote, caveman to what we are today. And so it's often been thought that during that Big Bang, that must have been when human beings started speaking. And that's been a rather prevalent theory, particularly over about the past 15 years. And it's seductive. When Homo, as opposed to Homo sapiens, but the genus Homo emerges about 2 million years ago, after that, 500,000 years ago, human brains were already as big as ours. And yet, there was none of this Big Bang. And then, 100,000 years ago, Neanderthals' brains were actually bigger, with it acknowledged that the correlation between brain size and brain power is approximate. But there are things to be seen. And yet, there was no development. This Big Bang only happened 50,000 years ago. There's a wonderful quote about this by Derek Bickerton, who has done a lot of very interesting work on language evolution. And he notices that there are remains of humans found in caves in Zhukudian, China. and it starts at 500,000 years ago and goes to 200,000 years ago, and there's no development. And so the way he describes it is they sat for 0.3 million years in the drafty, smoky caves of Jukutian, cooking bats over smoldering embers and waiting for the caves to fill up with their own garbage. And that is what they did. And there was certainly a kind of nobility about that, but still, that's not the Big Bang. They give no evidence of being as sharp and self-destructive as we are. And so many people have thought, well, there must be this mutation that happened around 50,000 years ago. Now, you're going to keep reading that, I'm sure, because 50,000 sits well in the memory. And at this point, there are people who have their careers hinging on this 50,000. I think that the evidence for that is falling apart. It's not that the idea is wrong, but it's just that it's a little less dramatic. A lot of evidence suggests that humans were sophisticated in the sense that we were long before 50,000 years ago. And to give a sense that this is not just idle dates, remember, 150,000 years ago, that's when the species arose. So that's our benchmark. And then here we are. So it's been said that the Big Bang is about here. But really, there's evidence that it goes much further back as we discover more and more evidence of early man. There are all sorts of evidence that this sophistication that we're talking about probably happened very gradually, starting 2 million years ago before there was a Homo sapiens, and gradually came up to this. Now, there are a lot of people that like gradualism, the idea of it being step by step by step by step by step. I think that from what I've seen, the evidence is that there was a certain acceleration at a certain point. Homo sapiens is special, but it was possibly a good 80,000, maybe 90,000, maybe 100,000 years ago. The findings, particularly in southern Africa, are showing that there were sophisticated pieces of art, for example, long before 50,000 years ago. The bit about 50,000 years ago has always surprised me, actually, because if you just do a little bit of rooting around in the field of human evolution, you find that it's generally supposed that humans reached Australia and New Guinea 70,000 years ago. At this point now, I would say at least. And so there was always this idea that there was this Big Bang that went on in Europe and perhaps the northern reaches of Africa and the Middle East, and that then there was all of this sophistication. But then, on the other hand, all the people involved, any reputable social scientist would say that all humans now are the exact same species, same genetic specifications except for small flutter at the edges. And that is what people genuinely believe. But if the Big Bang happened way over in Europe and its environs, then what was going on with all those people down in New Guinea and Australia and all the people in southern Asia and other places that humans are documented to have gotten by then? And the answer until then for many people is just diffusion. And diffusion is often a kind of a weasel word in many fields in social science, including in this one, linguistics. How would it have diffused? And diffusion also seems to often indicate dilution. How would this perfect equal degree of sophistication have gotten all over the world? It never seemed to quite make sense. If the Big Bang was further back, then we're on better ground, because then we can have the Big Bang happening in Africa, where it's now certain that our species arose. Then, once the species started radiating out of Africa, everybody had that same kit of sophistication to deal with. And so it works better. There is a wonderful new book, which is called The Real Eve, Modern Man's Journey Out of Africa, which is one of the books on this topic which is more readable than many. With many of the books on this, you start to get bogged down in, you know, genes with names and plateaus of Iran. This one actually keeps you going for the most part, and it's cutting edge. I highly recommend it. The title, The Real Eve, is unfortunate, because that and the cover make it look like it's about something very different. But it's a nice one. And in any case, it seems that human language most likely emerged in Africa, and probably with the emergence of Homo sapiens, possibly earlier species of Homo. And there is support for this in that there is a gene called the FOXP2 gene, and it seems to trace back 100,000 years, which is pretty nice, and it's long before that 50,000-year mark that the Big Bang people specify as being the birth of language. Now, as it happens, there is a certain amount of evidence that we are genetically specified to speak in this way. And it's a very controversial theory. It's even somewhat repulsive to many. And as such, I have to introduce it to you. And so that will be the topic of the next lecture.